Arthur Mansion, Oxford. There are strange things lost and forgotten in obscure corners of the newspaper. This is a podcast that aims to show the truth in that statement. Hello, and welcome to the first episode of Forgotten Darkness. I'm Andrew Gable. Since this is a new podcast, I suppose that first things first, I should really introduce myself and describe what I want to do on this show. I'm the author of a book called Mystery Animals of Pennsylvania. But before that, I was a little kid interested in dinosaurs, mythology, monsters, horror movies, all the things that somebody interested in these sorts of topics was probably interested in as a kid. I suppose you could say I was always going to end up researching unexplained and odd topics because, I mean, I had a dad who was really interested in history, a grandpa who was a big hunter and fisherman, and always told me stories of things that were out in the woods. Went to Gettysburg more times than I can remember. At some point in high school, I read Lauren Coleman's Mysterious America, and soon after that, I began collecting reports of various unexplained phenomena. I'm not really sure when I became interested in true crime stories as well. Somewhere in high school, I think. It might have even been earlier than that, back when I first heard stories of a place near here called Ray Myers Hollow and the murder that took place there. Because of my dad, I've always been really interested in history, and in researching my book, I found a lot of stories, odd and little heard stories, while I was going through old newspapers. Some of those made it into the book, and a whole lot of those really didn't, because they had, nothing to really do with what I was talking about. The quote from Arthur Machen in the intro is definitely a true one, though. And through this podcast, I just want to bring some of those overlooked stories out into wider knowledge. Some of them are true crime stories, some are just odd stories from history, some are quote-unquote unexplained, and I'd also like to eventually get into some of the more overlooked stories from the literature of unexplained phenomena, because I think if you go back through some of the older sources, older books, there's some stories that used to be like classics, and they used to be discussed all the time, and as far as I know, haven't ever been disproven, and it really wouldn't matter if they had been, that you just you never hear about now. The first episode here today, we'll be discussing a story which takes place in Lockhaven, which is about 3 hours north of me in the mountains of northern Pennsylvania, not very far from Penn State. This is a story which has always fascinated me since I first read it, since I first heard about it while I was researching my book. Not only because it's very much a mystery, but it's also because I went to college in Lockhaven, so all the places discussed in the story, I know where they are, or more precisely where they were, since not really any of them are actually there anymore. But this is the story of a 29-year-old man who was originally from Beach Creek, which is a little town a bit up the road from Lockhaven, and it takes place in 1915. And at the time, Lockhaven was a pretty small town. It still is really a small town, built mostly on the lumber industry, and the railroads and canals were also major industries in the area. And well, now Lockhaven's not a town as it used to be, because most of the industries have moved out. The railroad's still pretty active, but there used to be a paper mill in town that moved out. That's out of business, and the town's kind of, they have businesses, but not what they once did. So David Miles Shearer lived in a house at number 9 Second Street, just off the railroad tracks. His house isn't there anymore now, and it's actually, the space where his house was actually occupied by the back room of a hardware store. He lived there with a married woman whose name was Viola Kleckner, who was his quote-unquote housekeeper. But she was also known to some people as Viola Shearer, so the nature of their relationship was not really that of an employer and employee. David himself was also married, though his wife, Florence DeHaas, was back in Beach Creek with her daughter. David didn't have the best reputation in town, and he seemed to be quite the womanizer and homewrecker. Or, as the newspaper said, he was popular with the ladies. Well, anyway, Viola had gone to the nearby town of Emporium, which is another lumber town some 50 miles northwest of Lockhaven, to look for a job for herself, and she was going to try to find one for David as well. There's no word as to what was prompting this, whether, like, there was some reason her and David were leaving Lockhaven, or if she just merely gonna leave her husband behind and move away, so her and David could, you know, start a new life in Emporium. So she went to Emporium with David's 10-year-old son Willard, and David was gonna follow soon after that. And he had apparently told acquaintances he was going to have a celebration. I'm not sure exactly what he meant by that, but, I mean, honestly, given his reputation around town, I think we can probably guess. The last time anyone heard from David was on the morning of June 8th, when a neighbor named Sylvester Smith called to speak to him on the phone. Meanwhile, Viola had written to David a couple times, letting him know that she found jobs for them both in an Emporium hotel. But after a few days, he hadn't written back or shown up. So she wrote to her sister, which was a Mrs. R.A. Ludlow of Mill Hall, which is not yet another town near Lockhaven, to ask her to go check up on David. So Mrs. Ludlow sent her husband over to David's house around noon on June 10th to see what was going on. And he let himself in through the back door and immediately noticed a foul smell. Well, this is a true crime story, so you can probably guess what the smell was. Going upstairs, he found David's body lying on his bed, dressed in a suit and tie with a bloody face. Mr. Ludlow phoned the police, and when they arrived, they initially surmised that Shearer had committed suicide, as there was an empty envelope of potassium cyanide on the nightstand. I know, that seemed rather odd to me at first when I first found this story, but at the time, like, cyanide was legal, and it was pretty commonly used as an insecticide, and among other uses. It was noted that the stench was so strong, police could only remain in the room for a few minutes at a time, because decomposition was... He was apparently decomposed more than would be expected for how long he possibly could have been dead. So that may be important. Another thing that I was questioning to myself when I was reading it was why, if you find a body with a face that's all bloody, you'd conclude that he poisoned himself. Well, that was probably because it was cyanide, and from what I was able to determine, cyanide poisoning often causes, like, a ruddy, deep red appearance, because it breaks some of the blood vessels and stuff under the skin, so you get, like, a flushed appearance. The body was removed by the undertaker, who was an E.B. Waters, who had an office on Bellefont Avenue. And Waters washed the blood off the body's face and discovered to his horror that, contrary to the initial impressions, he didn't think Shearer had been a mere suicide. There were fairly large incisions around his eyes, and his eyes had been cut out. And there was a ragged tear found around one of his nostrils. And it was discovered that apparently some sort of sharp implement had been inserted in through his nose and forced out through his brain and out the top of his skull. And there is a small little hole in his head, obviously. Well, investigation determined only a couple things before it stalled out. First was that Shearer had purchased the cyanide at the Hilton and Hefner Pharmacy, which was on Bellefonte Avenue, which was also actually across the street from the Undertaker's office. This is another building that's not there anymore, but it was on the grounds of Triangle Park in Lock Haven today. It turns out that David had bought the poison to kill his dog before he went to Emporium, which, in my mind, goes to show that he wasn't only a womanizing and home-wrecking asshole, but he was apparently a dog-killing asshole, too. It was determined that separating the Shearer and Smith houses was only a thin, cheaply made wooden wall. But Sylvester Smith had heard nothing strange from next door in the days immediately prior to the discovery of the body. So, whatever happened to Shearer, it must have been a quiet death. The investigation seems to have had some problems, though. It might be because we're dealing with a rural area in 1915 and medicine was fairly primitive by today's standards. But it's puzzling to me that the coroner, L.L. Likens, didn't check the body for the presence of poison. Because based on, you know, what you can determine from other articles I was looking at, he seems to have been a pretty thorough doctor in general who knew his shit. And yeah, modern toxicology was unknown, but the doctors of the day were still able to examine the stomach of the deceased to detect the presence of at least, like, an ingested poison anyway. But this wasn't done. It was apparently attempted later, on June 19th, after Shearer had been buried for a week, but obviously those results were inconclusive. And this is doubly confusing, because there was a report from June 12th that indicated that Likens was shipping the stomach to Philadelphia for more thorough testing. So, had he exhumed Shearer to confirm what the doctors in Philadelphia found? If he was gonna do this, though, it would seem like it would be kind of counterproductive to send it off, rebury it, and then just dig it back up a couple days later. Had the report of him shipping it to Philadelphia simply been that he intended to do it? And if he just intended to do it, you know, why was it like a week yet till he got around to doing it when you weren't going to get good results anymore? But anyway, likely only one of those accounts is accurate, and the account of him being exhumed is from the Lock Haven paper, so I'm going with that's the one that happened. Coincidentally, there was a baby that died in that same room on 9 Street that Shearer was murdered in about 7 months later. There was no indication that was anything other than natural, so, you know, I'm not suggesting any kind of weird supernatural thing, but it's still an interesting coincidence to consider. Finally, we come to the oddest thing I think about the case, which is the singular lack of documentation. No police records can be found, which, I guess in itself, that's not really that weird. Because not a lot of police departments will keep detailed records of an investigation that occurred as long ago as that did. But the Clinton County Courthouse has almost every coroner's report going back to the 1800s, but the report on Shearer is missing. His death certificate exists, but that seems to have what I think is an anomaly. Although determination of an exact time of death was most likely rendered more difficult than normal because of the increased rate of decomposition, The certificate lists his death as having occurred at 5 a.m. on June 8th. And that just seems very oddly specific to me. I almost wonder if they were using the time when Sylvester Smith last talked to Shearer as his time of death, which, you know, it almost appears that way. But, I mean, why would you really do that? Why would you just not write unknown? Whatever. The final verdict on the death certificate is homicide in a manner not known, which is what I've titled this episode. And it's what it is, really. I can't for the life of me figure out what this object that pierced his skull could have possibly been, short of a nail actually hammered through his nose. Homicide in a manner not known. There the case has lain for 103 years, and it's likely where it's gonna stay. As gruesome and bizarre as the murder, if it indeed was a murder, we'll get back to that in a minute, was, and as noteworthy as it should have been in a small town like Lockhaven, you'd think there'd be more documentation of it. But that's not quite the end of David Shearer's story. There was another mention of the case made on June 16th in a current happenings column and in the Altoona newspaper that called that into question. If anyone's looked through old newspapers, you know how they used to have those columns that were composed of little one or two sentence summaries of events. And this was in one of those. Anyway, this one said that the current thinking about the Shearer case was that he was indeed just a suicide, and that any of the wounds on the body were actually the result of predation on the corpse by rats rather than by the blade or whatever of a murderer. So this version of the story is actually supported by other events, in my opinion. It was noted in some articles that Shearer had been drinking very heavily for the past week, presumably ever since Viola left. And there were rumors that he was estranged from the rest of his family as well. At any rate, the fact that the death was quiet, as implied by Sylvester Smith's statement, would support a suicide theory, in my opinion, even though, I mean, if this was the case, however, signing a death certificate with a verdict of homicide when you don't really know that it is a homicide yet is very irresponsible, don't you think? The end of the David Shearer story. There's really not any more to it than that. This would be a very short episode, which is not the most promising thing for a first episode of a podcast. So I was searching around for articles on another episode that I'm planning on doing in the future. And in doing so, I found another story, which it was weird, very weird, but also just happens to be from Flemington, which is right beside Lockhaven. In fact, the two towns, now anyway, are basically not even two towns. They just kind of run together. I had posted this on my Facebook today, so by the time this article comes out, a decent number of people have probably seen this this article, probably know this story already. I'm just going to read the entire thing, because the story's pretty complicated and weird sounding. I don't really know what to call this. Maybe some sort of hex witchcraft type thing. I don't know. See what you think. This is called The Tale of a Severed Arm. Worried the victim until he cast it into a furnace. Flemington, December 1st. The case of George F. Han of this place has been puzzling the skill of the medical fraternity for nearly 2 years. Han was a mail clerk on the Pennsylvania Railroad between Flemington and Lambertville. While at Ringo's, which is a town I never heard of, he attempted to couple a car. His arm was caught between the bumpers and was terribly mangled. The arm was amputated below the elbow. Since that hour, Han has not passed an hour free from distress. He told his attendants that his arm had been carelessly placed into a box and was cramped up. To satisfy the injured man, the limb was dug up. It was found exactly as Han had described. The arm was again buried, but was placed into a larger box. This appeared to relieve Han somewhat. Sometime later, he grew worse and was sent to a Philadelphia hospital, where another piece of his arm was taken off. This did not relieve him, and a few days ago, a third operation was performed. Han then said there was a stone lying upon his buried member. The severed arm was again dug up by his father, who found it in the condition his son had described. It was reburied. Yesterday, the injured man was informed that if he cremated the severed arm, his pains would gradually stop. This morning, he had the arm exhumed again. He took it to the Pennsylvania Railroad Depot, where he threw it into the fire in the engine that had caused his suffering. Now he feels much relieved. And that is from the Philadelphia Inquirer for December 2nd of 1896. Yes, I don't know what to call that story. Sounds almost there at the end when it says about cremating the severed arm and his pains would stop. It almost sounds like a hex powwow, you know, sort of witchcraft thing. But yeah, I don't know what to call that. A new definition of phantom pain, I guess. I don't know. There, the first episode of this podcast will end. I'm hoping to release an episode a week, maybe every other week. It's a beginning podcast, so, I mean, I'm just getting things sorted out with this, so don't expect it to be great at first. Have a comment, a question, a comment, or if you know a lesser-known story that you'd like to see covered, post it to our Facebook page at Forgotten Darkness Podcast, or send it to our email at forgottendarkness77f(d) @gmail.com. And so, until next episode, this is Andrew, signing off.